This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we hear from an infectious disease specialist on two Omicron COVID subvariants that are dominating COVID cases in the United States. Now, a mass shooting at a 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois on Monday left 7 people dead, more than 36 injured. Police say a 21-year-old has confessed to the killings and that he used a Smith & Wesson M&P-15, which he bought legally, along with several other firearms. Earlier today, the Lake County Sheriff's Department also said in a press conference that the alleged perpetrator then drove to Madison and considered further violence.
Investigators did develop some information that it appears when he drove to Madison, he was driving around. However, he did see a celebration that was occurring in Madison, and he seriously contemplated using the firearm he had in his vehicle to commit another shooting.
In Madison.
Did you know how much ammunition he had at that point?
Approximately 60 rounds.
Since the shooting, Vice President Harris called on Congress to bring back a federal ban on assault weapon sales. The country did ban the sale of many firearms designated as assault weapons in a law passed in 1994. It was designated as a 10-year law and expired in 2004. How effective was that ban in reducing mass violence, if at all? Are there other ways we can make tragedies like the Highland Park shooting more preventable? Less deadly? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of a new assault weapons ban? Or how about more specific things like limiting the amount of ammunition in magazines? If you're a firearm owner, what are your thoughts on the availability of these weapons? Are there regulations you would be okay with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. James Allen Fox is the Lippman Family Professor of Criminology, Law, and Public Policy at Northeastern University and a regular contributor for USA Today. He's written many books on violence and criminology and maintains a mass killing database with Northeastern University, USA Today, and the AP. James, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Take us back to 1994. What regulations were put in place? How were these assault weapons, I guess, defined as a category?
Well, the term assault, there's no set definition of assault weapon. It can be defined in any way you want, and it's really, in terms of practice, defined by legislation. The 1994 law essentially listed particular weapons that were to be outlawed. It's really what's about the thing about assault weapons is what's attached to them, in particular things like a large capacity magazine. That makes them deadly, or the fact that if it can accept a silencer. That's sort of what is the concern, not the fact that it's just a rifle otherwise.
What I know, there's been a lot of research trying to figure out if that ban made much difference. It seems like maybe not. What do you see when you look back at that 10-year span that this ban was in place?
I see largely not, although there's some difference of opinions in terms of data. But mass shootings did not decline during that ban. It's hard to tell for sure because there are a lot of other factors that affect mass shootings. But the thing is that the vast majority of the mass shootings involve handguns, actually, not rifles or assault weapons. And that's one of the problems. Plus, there were plenty of so-called assault weapons in circulation already, even though the sale was banned, that doesn't mean they couldn't be traded or sold privately. So the effect was minimal at best.
Now, if a new ban were to be put in place, it seems like in a lot of ways we have a lot more of these weapons out in the public already. Do you think that might make it even less effective to try to reimpose something like that 94 ban today?
Well, I think whatever we do would be a good idea, but we have to have realistic expectations as to what effect it might have. As you say, there are plenty of them already in circulation, and there's no talk about a buyback or confiscation of these weapons, only perhaps that they wouldn't be sold going forward. But again, it all depends on how you define an assault weapon. For example, two of the largest mass shootings in our history were committed with handguns. The Virginia Tech shooting of 32 and the shooting in Luby's Cafeteria in Texas back in 1991 with 23 were killed. Those were committed with a Glock handgun. but a Glock that was fashioned with a large capacity magazine. So it's not so much the rifle or the gun, it's the attachment. So in fact, we recently completed research we published last year looking at what state laws had with regard to guns and the rate of mass shootings in state by state. And we found there were two things, the two laws that made a difference in terms of the rate or lethality of mass shootings. One is permits to purchase, which is different than a universal background check. Universal background check really just means that private sales as well would go through the FBI's background check. A permit to purchase allows local agencies, such as police departments, to make decisions about the suitability of someone to give them a permit based on far more information than just whether they have a criminal record, a felony record, or whether they've been institutionalized involuntarily. We found that states that have permits to purchase have significantly lower incidence of mass shootings. Secondly, states that had bans on large capacity magazines had significantly lower casualty counts, both deaths and injuries, when there was a mass shooting. So there are things we can do to reduce the likelihood, and in particular, the severity of mass shootings when they occur.
Is that something you think could be effective at the federal level? You were just talking about state laws there.
Sure, it could. The question is whether it could pass. But states that have the will and have enacted these restrictions, it has made a difference.
Talking to James Allen Fox, criminology professor at Northeastern University, looking at gun regulations, especially ones related to mass shootings, what works, what doesn't, what is possible. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. John is with us in Stevenson, Michigan. Hi, John.
Hey, listen, I'm a hunter safety instructor now for about 16 years. And in the sporting field, like when we go deer hunting, it's the law. We can have no more than 5 rounds in our weapon or our deer rifle. If we get caught with more, we get a fine. Or if we're waterfowl hunting, we can have no more than 3 rounds in a shotgun. If we get caught with more in those, DNR will give us a fine. So in seeing how we protect the wildlife so well, should we limit the magazine capacity for those other types of weapons, like the assault weapons? Let's limit them to 5 like they limit the sportsmen's to 5. I think that should be a good way to go without having to totally, get away with that type of weapon. Limit the magazines.
John, thanks for the call. James, what do you think?
Well, I would agree. I'm not sure we would see it with 5, but the states that have these bans usually set a limit at 10. But I certainly agree. You know, there on the market, you can buy the drum magazines that hold 100 rounds. It's amazing what capacity someone can have. So, and also point out that the Second Amendment says nothing about the amount of ammunition one can have. So it's not a violation of the Second Amendment to implement a ban. One thing I also want to point out, you said something at the end about what the federal government can do as opposed to states. The federal government is sort of the lowest common denominator. In fact, it is pretty low in terms of the federal law. And states can do a lot better. And many of them have.
Thanks for that call, John, at 800-642-1234. I want to listen to a comment here from Dr. David Baum from Highland Park, Illinois. He was on the scene treating victims just after the shooting, talking about the impact, the lethality of the firearm involved. Here's what he had to say talking to CNN.
The horrific scene of some of the bodies is unspeakable for the average person. I mean, having been a physician, I've seen things in ERs, and you do see lots of blood, but the bodies were literally, some of the bodies were, there was an evisceration injury from the power of this gun and the bullets. There was another person who had an unspeakable head injury. Unspeakable. So these are the bullets and guns that 18-year-olds have a right to shoot down on a parade in a sleepy little community July 4th parade.
James, I've seen similar comments from surgeons and others who have worked on shooting victims from AR-15 style rifles. There's a concern that these armaments are really efficient at transmitting the energy from the ammunition into the human body. Is there something about the lethality of a particular type of firearm that could be regulatable?
Well, I don't know. That would be a very difficult law to pass. You have to define lethality. But one thing I want to say, based on the comment about 18-year-olds, I was disappointed that in the federal law that we did not see the minimum age for purchasing a long gun, which includes an AR-15, raised to 21, which is the same age that is the minimum for a handgun. The idea that we're going to have enhanced background checks looking at juvenile records as well, I'm not sure how much that's going to do. Because, you know, most mass shooters do not have a criminal record, either juvenile or adult. Their first crime is the massacre. So I'm not sure that kind of enhanced background check will get at the issue. The problem is that 18-year-olds are too impulsive. We know that. We know a lot about brain development, and certainly the portion of the brain that controls your ability to think things through and to make good decisions doesn't develop actually until age 25. The irony is, you know, you could have an 18-year-old who takes an AR-15 that he purchases legally, go into a liquor store, hold up the liquor store, not for the cash, but for the beer that he can't buy legally.
We're talking to James Allen Fox, professor of criminology, law, and public policy at Northeastern University, about calls for some kind of new assault weapons ban after Monday's shooting in Illinois, and what the data tells us about gun violence and what works to prevent mass shootings. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, take some more of your calls coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with James Allen Fox, criminologist at Northeastern University, looking at the idea of an assault weapons ban that's been backed by President Biden and other measures aimed at reducing gun violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Joe is with us in Warrens. Joe, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Joe?
Well, I understand all the problems that they have with the guns and stuff. I'm from a long line of family hunters and shooters and stuff. I teach hunter safety. I teach pellet rifle, archery, shotgun, .22, and we teach safety and stuff. And what I'm trying to say is I could have, earlier I told a lady, I could have a 100-round magazine laying on the table, and if nobody ever touched it, that gun would never hurt anybody, whether it had one round or 100 rounds. I think we need to do way more background checks on the people, and especially they seem to be younger people that like to be doing this, or not like to be doing it, but they're doing it. I think there's a lot of safety that's going on out there. I know people that have, between my son and I, we probably got over 60, 70 guns. And we have yet to ever have a problem, and it's just because we teach the hunter safety and the people, we think about everything that's going on. So I don't know if there's mental problems out there that need to be dealt with, but I don't think you're going to try to take the guns and limit people on anything that they can own by doing a gun ban.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. James, you gave us a lot to work with there. Take it where you want to go.
Well, you know, the people always say we want to keep dangerous guns out of the hands of dangerous individuals, but that's far more easy to say than to do. One, how do we define someone who's dangerous? That's complicated. Let me talk for a moment about red flag laws, which has, of course, become popular in the wake of mass shootings. All the red flag laws that we have in this country have been motivated by homicides, the first one being Indiana that followed a homicide of a police officer, second one being Connecticut following the Sandy Hook shooting, and a lot of them following Parkland shooting. And the evidence, the research evidence about the effectiveness shows that it has an effect on suicide. But there has been no evidence, no research actually, on the impact on homicide. And, you know, it's easy to say we need a red flag law, but one has to be very careful, because if someone's homicidal and you attempt to take away their gun, we have to do it very carefully and with all the rights that they should have. Because if someone's homicidal, that attempt to confiscate their gun against their will can actually be the very very act that could set off what we don't want to happen.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Yordis in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hello. I think this is an emergency situation. Obviously, over 300 mass murders in this country so far this year. And I'm suggesting that police officers join with nurses and doctors and first responders and threaten to strike and say, we will not continue working until you change these laws. They are the ones that are seeing these horrors, these war zones in our country. And I have so much respect for them, but they shouldn't have to see that. They shouldn't have to be in a war zone in their own country. Thank you.
Yordis, thanks for the call. James, the risk to police officers, one read on what happened in Uvalde, Texas, was police officers felt outgunned as they were out in the hallway of the school there.
Yeah, well, there were lots of issues with Uvalde in terms of their response.
Sure.
They did not follow the proper protocols. Let me say something about what the caller just said. Mm-hmm. He said there had been 300 mass murders this year. That's not true. Depends how you define a mass shooting. See, the 300 is 400 people shot, but not necessarily killed. In fact, in those 300, about 260 deaths have occurred. Most mass shootings don't even have any deaths. What I study is mass killings, 400 people killed. And so far, we've had 15 this year. So there's no real epidemic here, although there is an epidemic of fear. And there's an exaggerated sense of what the likelihood is. These are rare events, often when they occur, but still, they are rare. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything about it. It is a problem. It's just not an epidemic.
Yordis, thanks for the call. Jimmy joins us next in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Afternoon, gents. Yeah, I think you're on to something with the limitation on the magazine size. I've got a 30-06 semi-automatic I use for deer hunting, and of course it only holds 5 rounds, and I don't see the need for my purposes anyway to get any bigger. But I don't know if there'd be a buyback, or I mean, you ban the sale, but then a buyback or something. I can't see the cops that are confiscating them. But I just had one quick comment on the 18-21 thing. If it's a right in the Constitution, I think you're going to run into the Supreme Court problem, because it's a right under the Second Amendment, not like alcohol where there's actually nothing in there. So I think that, you know, why should an 18-year-old, once they are of age, be banned from a constitutional right? And I'll take my comments off there.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. His second point there, James, go ahead.
No one's ever challenged, at least I don't know they've challenged, the fact that you have to be 21 to buy a handgun. If that's appropriate, a 21 minimum for handgun, I see no reason why it would be unconstitutional to require an age of 21 for a long gun.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. And Jimmy says, you know, he's fine with 5 rounds in his 30-06. Is there a number you'd want to see, James, as a cap for ammunition capacity?
Well, going by the practice of many states that have imposed these bans, 10 is the maximum. 10 is the limit. I'm not sure. I mean, the lower the number you have, the more resistance you're going to have to such an act or an attempt to pass something. So 10 as a maximum seems to be a reasonable number. And it's certainly enough for people who want to use the weapon for hunting or as self-defense.
Thanks a lot for that call. James, you're skeptical about a number of the measures that people float around out there. If Congress came to you and said, all right, we're going to work together, James, and we want your, you know, top 3 list, what kind of things would you offer them when it comes to preventing mass killings with firearms?
Sure. First of all, I'd raise the age, not just to 21. I'd actually like it to be 25 if I had my brothers, but definitely 21 for both handguns and rifles. Secondly, limit the size of high-capacity magazines. to 10 rounds at most. And then third, as I mentioned, have a much more thorough background check system, such as the permit to purchase, where local law enforcement can look at a variety of things in making a decision whether someone should have a permit. You know, for example, the FBI in their NICS system, the background check system, wouldn't know, for example, if the police had been to a certain address because the mother keeps calling that her son is acting out. But a local cop would. So I think that local agencies can make better decisions about who should have a right to have a gun and who should not. So those three things, permit to purchase, limit on the size of magazines, and raise the age for purchasing.
And very briefly, I know there's talk like, well, can't we figure out who is likely to do these kind of shootings? Just briefly, can you touch on the difficulty of profiling for who might be the next mass shooter?
Sure. In the aftermath of mass shooting, we see all those yellow flags that were missed. They're really yellow flags because they turn red once the blood is spilled on them. There are countless Americans who write ugly things on the internet, who are lonely, isolated, angry, who have all the characteristics that we often see in these shooters, but will never turn their angst into action. The problem is trying to identify them. The overwhelming majority of them will do nothing. And if we try to identify them, one, what are we going to do with them if they haven't committed a crime? And secondly, we'll have a large number of false positives. Predicting the next mass shooter is literally impossible, unfortunately.
James,
it's a rare event. That's the only silver lining here.
James, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's James Allen Fox, professor of criminology, law, and public policy at Northeastern University. He talked with us about the idea of bans on assault weapons, the 1994 ban on those weapons, whether other ideas could do more to save lives today. You can still let us know what you think about these various proposed regulations or what safety measures you think should be put in place. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, get a look at the real estate market in Wisconsin and the effort to add more housing into the mix. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates two new subvariants of Omicron are making up more than 70% of COVID-19 cases in the United States. Omicron BA4 and BA5 were first detected in the U.S. a couple of months after being detected in South Africa. With the rise in BA4 and BA5 cases, specialists are bringing up the possibility of an Omicron-targeted booster vaccine that could be ready for adults maybe as soon as this fall. Dr. Daniel Shirley is an infectious disease specialist at UW Health. Dr. Shirley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What, if any, are the differences in symptoms between BA4 and 5 and all the other variants we've had so far?
Well, there's really no expectation that the symptoms of this is going to be any different than the previous subvariants. Like we've talked about before, all of these subvariants are still Omicron, mm-hmm. and the symptoms are expected to be similar.
How do they compare when it comes to how contagious they are?
That's really the issue here and what people are concerned about. You know, we've done these kind of switches in the proportions of subvariants before, but each time we talk about the concern that it might be more transmissible, and that's sort of a natural way of viruses. Obviously, for it to overtake the other ones, it needs to be spread more successfully. So that really is the concern with these, especially BA5. It seems to be taking over and really seems to be more transmissible.
All right, that's contagion. Now, how about virulence, I think you call it in the industry? How dangerous these variants are? Do we have enough information to make a call on that so far?
We don't. This is a little bit like before, too, in that we really need to see what happens in real life. I think in the lab, there's a little bit of concern that it seems to have a predilection for the lungs again. But in places where this subvariant has already been seen, they haven't noticed any big differences in the type of disease that it causes. Obviously, this is very complicated because mm-hmm. people have different exposures to prior infection or vaccination, including multiple vaccinations. So, it's a little hard to compare one person to another. It really depends on your previous kind of antibody levels.
Now, it's more contagious, these two new variants of Omicron, or new-ish now. Does that mean they're better at overcoming vaccines or immunity from past exposure to some other kind of COVID?
Right. I think that what we're seeing with these new subvariants is that it escapes the immunity more readily. That means that even if you have antibodies from prior infection or vaccination, even if that was fairly recent, this subvariant seems to sort of disguise itself, and those antibodies don't work as well. So that's one of the things that makes it spread more readily, and really is the concern here, that like we've seen before, it's a combination. Even if it doesn't cause more severe disease, if it causes disease in lots of people, it still causes a big problem, and it can include increases in hospitalization.
That said, comparing someone who's completely unvaccinated and unexposed to somebody who's vaccinated or exposed to past COVID, you're still better off, right, with those antibodies?
Yeah, so what we're talking about is that it spreads more readily, but so far we haven't seen a huge uptick in hospitalizations. So however you've created those antibodies, and the safest way to do that is to get a vaccination, that does seem to still have some protection against getting severe disease. So that's really the message right now, that if you're eligible for this extra booster and you haven't gotten it yet, I think now is kind of the time to think about it with your doctor as we go into, you know, an increase in this subvariant.
Talking to Dr. Daniel Shirley, infectious disease specialist at UW Health, looking at the newest Omicron variants that seem to be in wide circulation here in the United States and in a lot of the world, too. There's been talk about more targeted vaccine boosters, kind of, I guess, updated and finagled to account for the Omicron variant. What are you watching for there?
You know, that's a little bit why I say if you're eligible for a booster now, I think it's worth thinking about, because there's a little bit of sort of discussion about how to make the next booster, whether that should be Omicron BA2, so specific to Omicron, but not necessarily specific to BA4 or 5, or should we wait and create a vaccine that's potentially targeted even more at the latest subvariant? So, you know, which kind of booster is rolled out may matter. And obviously, we can see how fast these subvariants can rise and take over. So you wouldn't want to create, put all your eggs in a basket, let's say.
Now, we've seen, it's hard, we haven't had enough years to maybe make predictions based on past years. There's concern, I know, that the fall in Wisconsin is a time when we could see numbers go back up. What are you watching for? Maybe what are you worried about as we head toward the fall?
So like many other respiratory viruses, the fall and winter is the time where those cases rise. And that has to do with, the temperature, people going inside, being in groups closer together, that type of stuff. So, you know, I think we're just have a general concern about that, that in past we've noticed increased cases of COVID in those time periods. Now, you know, with these kind of new variants and subvariants, I think it's even more concerning, so that we get the timing right, so that, you know, we have all the tools we need. The other big part of this, of course, is even outside of vaccines and other things, of just the general protections and when people should use those. Those things like spacing out, wearing masks when you're in crowded spaces, especially indoors, and improving our ventilation in general. That's easy in the summer when we're outside, but how do we do that as we go into the fall and winter?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the masking in particular. What are you telling people these days who ask when and where do I need to wear a mask?
Well, I think the first discussion is, are you indoors or outdoors? I think outdoors generally pretty safe as long as you can kind of space out to a degree. Once you're indoors, it's a little bit about how close are you going to be to other people and what's the ventilation in that location. And if you don't know what that's going to be like, I think the default would be to take a mask and wear it. If you're really going to be in a close proximity to people for a long period of time, that's when you think about increasing your mask level. That is, use an N95 or a KN95, something like that.
Dr. Shirley, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Daniel Surley, infectious disease specialist at UW Health. He joined us today to talk about the latest COVID-19 subvariants, BA4 and BA5, the possibility of Omicron-targeted vaccines that could be available as early as this fall. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a food tradition surrounding fish.
People have been fishing the Mississippi River for about 1,000 years. It's a tradition that's passed down through families for survival and recreation. Mike Valley is part of that tradition and one of the last people to still make a living as a commercial fisherman on the Upper Mississippi. And when he gets his catch, he often smokes it. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy hopped on Valley's boat to learn more about his smoked fish and his love of the river.
There are few fishermen like Mike Valley left on the Mississippi River.
The millions of pounds of fish that I've caught, it's still peace and tranquility for me out here. It is a lost art. It's a dying art. Like sitting here right now, I mean, this is just absolutely beautiful to me. To get out of that phone ringing, people knocking all day, every day, it's just like, ah.
Valley is a third-generation fisherman. The work is in his blood. He's owned Valley Fish and Cheese in Prairie du Chien since the 1980s. He grew up hunting, trapping, clamming, and working with his father. His dad also had a shop on the river and sold his fish to markets in Chicago, New York, and Boston. But as the fishing industry changed, Valley knew the only way he was going to survive was by forging his own path. Sell quality, fresh fish and products that you can't find anywhere else.
I've always said, you'll never have anyone come into my shop and then leave and then go home and tell all their friends and their relatives, this guy had beef jerky. Or, oh my God, he had Colby cheese. No, he had snapping turtle jerky, he had alligator jerky, catfish bologna, the weird things.
Valley is particular. Years of fishing and smoking his catch have taught him that you can't cut corners if you want to stand out. Even though he's caught millions of pounds of fish, the novelty hasn't worn off.
I still really, truly enjoy catching fish. The cleaning, not so much. But that's part of the job. Everybody that I take with me always, they're like, oh my God, this is so fun. This is really great. And then you get back and they go, see ya. So.
Valley cleans the fish, typically catfish, carp, buffalo, and sturgeon, up to 4 times. Then he brines it for at least half a day. Details matter. Not all fish are the same, and they shouldn't be treated the same, he says. The thicker the fish, the more salt you're going to need. And each fish gets its own brine with different seasonings that bring out its flavors. Then Valley puts the fish in the smoker, which he claims is the only licensed 100% wood smoker left in the state.
We light it with wood, it ends with wood. No liquid smoke, no gas, no nothing. And that is huge. It makes a world of difference. Basically, we're all hickory. Once in a while, we'll burn a little apple wood.
And it can't be rushed. Patience is key. Valley could finish the fish in an hour, but he prefers to give it 10 to 12 hours to really soak up the smoky flavor.
I relate it to a sponge. If you just barely hold it on the water, just missed it, it sucks it in and it takes time. So that's what you want to do with the fish. You want to very slowly permeate it and bring it up to temp. You know, otherwise if you just cook it, it's just a cooked piece of fish. Yeah. It isn't smoked.
1734.
Valley jokes about a law he has at Valley Fish and Cheese when customers make a modest purchase. Once you buy it and leave the door, you can't come back in and buy more.
I will literally, honestly, hear 10 times a day, this is unbelievable smoked fish. Well, it is. Because it was swimming yesterday and it's smoked today. It's to die for.
Yet all that being said, Valley says you don't necessarily need to head over to the Mississippi and catch the fish yourself. He recommends finding a nice piece of salmon or fish of your choice and practicing a little patience.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on Mike Valley's smoked fish. And this story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, sexually transmitted infection rates have been going up, even during the pandemic. We'll find out how to keep yourself and others safe and healthy. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The CDC says sexually transmitted infection, or STI, cases continued to climb in the first year of the pandemic as COVID-19's strain on the healthcare system affected testing and prevention efforts. The latest numbers for 2020 show congenital syphilis at its highest rate in 26 years, and people aged 15 to 24 contracted about half of 2020's reported infections. Megan Meller is an infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Megan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Those were the national CDC numbers I just mentioned. What are we seeing here in Wisconsin?
We're seeing the exact same thing in Wisconsin. So last Friday, the state of Wisconsin released their data. And honestly, it reflects everything that the CDC reported. So we're seeing the exact same trends at the state level and also at the local level here in La Crosse County.
This had been going on before the pandemic, right? This has been a trend, and the pandemic didn't stop it. What have you seen in the long term?
I think in the long term, it's really just more and more cases. So, you know, every year we kind of expect, even internally, when we start seeing more STI cases. You know, spring break, start of school, you know, here locally, Oktoberfest. But what we're seeing now is it's more and more cases. It's more among that 15 to 24-year-old population. We're also seeing more cases coming up among, I would say, the 45, 50-plus age group, too, which before, you know, that was rare. So overall, it's just increasing.
You have a message to share, I think, about access and availability to testing and prevention. What do you want people to know?
So testing is really important, and I really can't underscore that enough. You know, we see oftentimes what we see, especially among men, is they only get tested once they've been exposed or if they have symptoms. And what we really recommend for everyone is at the start of a new relationship, go ahead and get tested. It's so easy, and there's really affordable ways to get tested, whether it's through a primary care provider, Planned Parenthood, University Health is another really big avenue. But we often see, especially among men, is that they present to urgent care or the emergency department, which, you know, they will test, but that's often associated with a pretty significant cost too, when there's all these other really easy ways to go and get tested. And so we've worked really closely with the health department to explore how to get that education out there, that there's these other easy ways to get tested.
Prevention and testing are important. How many of the most common sexually transmitted infections are treatable?
All of them are treatable, and that's the really great thing. You know, I think what people don't know is that you can also be infected with these STIs and be asymptomatic, so not even realize. So one of the things we find is that's coming out in the data is that women are testing positive at a higher rate for especially like chlamydia and gonorrhea compared to men. And that's just because women are getting tested more regularly. You know, they're going in for their primary care appointments, and there's federal guidelines recommending that women do get tested frequently. So even if they're asymptomatic, they're catching it. When they're going in for prenatal appointments, we're catching it. But for men, we don't have those same guidelines. And so really, the best prevention is getting tested right away so you can get treated, because these are really treatable infections. You know, the antibiotics are, you know, they work really well. And you mentioned congenital infections too. So those are the infections passed from mom to baby. Those are really treatable, especially in those early stages of pregnancy when it hasn't yet, you know, transmitted to the baby. And so really testing and then getting treated right early on is critical.
Talking to Megan Meller, infection preventionist with Gunderson Health in La Crosse, looking at a steady rise in sexually transmitted infections in the United States. And as you heard earlier, that's true here in Wisconsin as well. Now, you mentioned earlier, 15 to 24-year-olds have a lot of the cases of these STIs. What kind of outreach do you see as being important to spread the message to help prevent these diseases?
One of the really great things about being in the healthcare system right now is there's a really great collaborative I'm a part of with La Crosse County that's also partnered with Planned Parenthood and Student Health. And we're really pulling on college students to help us do that outreach. So to do the research, to understand what are the behaviors and attitudes that are driving, you know, this increase in STIs, and then what are successful ways to address it, you know, because they're the ones that are, you know, in that culture already. So they have a really good understanding, you know, to start asking those questions and then to help us develop effective ways to address it. So those are some of the avenues that we're looking forward to in the next year is expanding upon and really utilizing those, that age group.
Now, when I was in that age group, I'll age myself here, the AIDS epidemic was all over the news and the headlines. And I think it got people talking and being willing to be very frank about safe sex and sexually transmitted illnesses. Do you see a reluctance to talk about that? Is this something that's on people's radar?
You know, you touched right on it. We definitely do see a reluctance. And and part of it too is, I think, this misconception with birth control. And so birth control is so widely available, you know, and it's a wonderful thing, but most birth controls don't provide protection against STIs. Only the barrier methods do, like condoms. And what we're finding is that condom use really is declining among this population. They, you know, they're relying more on that birth control. And so part of the education that we're trying to get out is that it's really important to use those barrier methods as a form of protection against these STIs.
Now, do you have thoughts on how parents can have that conversation with their kid as they approach that age group?
I think having this very open and honest conversation about it and not, you know, shaming it, you know, it's a part of, you know, health is getting tested. Another thing that's really important to note too, I think children over the age, the health department over the age of 12 can get tested without parental consent. So if they go into their doctor, they can get tested and their parents don't, you know, need to know about it. But I think it's even better for parents to kind of have that honest conversation with their child and make sure that if their child is sexually active, that they're using, you know, they're using contraceptives and also getting tested regularly.
And for especially people in that younger age group that's most at risk, for people who are sexually active, what's the recommendation how often they should get tested?
We recommend getting tested, you know, anytime you have symptoms, you know, that, you know, you find questionable, if you want to go get, that's a good, you know, easy way first to get tested. We also recommend at the start of any new sexual relationship is to go, and in fact, both partners can go and get tested before you become sexually active. That's a really easy way to, again, to make sure that you're not, you know, you're not spreading these infections further, because so many of them do present asymptomatic, especially among men. And so again, making sure that even if you don't have any symptoms, you're just going ahead and seeking that testing and getting that answer done.
I've mostly been asking about individual testing and treatment. Are there community level efforts that seem to be especially effective?
In terms of, you know, community efforts that we're finding effective, it's just some public health outreach. You know, using social media has been effective and other public health departments across the country. So utilizing Twitter, putting ads out on dating apps too, has been relatively effective. But again, I think some of it, you have to go at it from multiple ways to start seeing more acceptance of testing, barrier methods, and treatment.
And just our last minute, Megan, maybe a dumb question here. We used to say STDs a lot more, sexually transmitted diseases. Now it seems like STI, sexually transmitted infections, is what people do. Same thing, or is there an important distinction there?
You know, I think it is the same thing, but when I think of infections, I think of those who are also asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. And so with diseases, you're actually having symptoms. And so this, using this new terminology, highlights the fact that you might not even have symptoms, but you'll still be able to transmit it to a partner.
Megan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Megan Miller, infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Megan was with us today to talk about what she's seeing in terms of sexually transmitted infection rates and what people can do to stay healthy as the CDC reports those numbers going up around the country. Same is true here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, what gives meaning to life? The answer to that question may have changed lately for many Americans. A philosopher joins the show for a look at the search for meaning, and you could share your answer to that question. We'll look at a case that the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear later this year that could have a big impact on how states manage presidential and other federal elections. And how do non-human animals see the world and hear and smell and feel the world? Check out The Sensory World of Animals. We'll talk to the author of An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. You can let us know if your dog or cat seem to perceive things that you cannot. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.